From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. Former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer has been cheering from the peanut gallery this season for his Los Angeles Clippers to make the NBA Finals. Ahead in Only a Game, why the Clippers owner might be the most normal billionaire in the stand. Also, the NFL's latest concussion settlement. Best-selling author Christopher McDougall makes the bold leap from barefoot running to parkour, and you can throw out the record books when St. John's College and Navy meet in the 33rd installment of croquet's most intense rivalry. Also coming up, remembering the 1979 Oakland A's home game that may have been the most poorly attended Major League tilt in history.
The third baseman went around thanking everyone for coming and for staying out in the cold. They could hear people ordering peanuts from the outfield. So just a massive empty place.
Stay tuned. On April 29th of 2014, newly minted NBA Commissioner Adam Silver banned then Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling for life after racist comments by Sterling had infuriated pretty much everybody and had taken some of the luster off the first round of the NBA postseason. But the 2015 NBA playoffs are underway without such distractions. Sterling is gone, replaced in August by former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer, whose image New York Times columnist Karen Krause describes as more JCPenney than J. Crew. Karen, welcome back to Only a Game.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Steve Ballmer, who is worth somewhere around $24 billion, give or take a billion, expresses his enthusiasm for the Clippers loudly and often at games on the sidelines. Is that why you describe him as more JCPenney than J. Crew?
That's part of it, but he doesn't even have courtside seats. He's got a baseline seat. He is the antithesis of the owner looking to draw attention to himself. And yet he manages to do that because he screams like a hyena when he gets overly excited about how his team is doing. He dresses in button-down plaid shirts that any sixth grader would be embarrassed that his mom was buying him for school, and hockeys and sneakers. And when people told me this, they meant it as the ultimate compliment, because his enthusiasm for basketball in general and the Clippers in particular is authentic.
Still, Steve Ballmer lives in Seattle, and he travels to Clippers games
right.
on his private jet, so he's not exactly Mr. Blue Collar, right?
No, and I talked to a lot of season ticket holders, including a couple whose families had had season tickets since the Clippers were in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I heard again and again was this was the one thing that made them queasy, is that this guy really does not represent the melting pot that the Clippers season ticket holders represent. In the preseason, there were these big banners outside Staples Center of Blake Griffin, of Chris Paul, and then of Ballmer, which was very unsettling to these diehard fans. They didn't want their owner to be one of the attractions, but those banners disappeared once the regular season began. And I think the Clipper fans do appreciate that he is an authentic basketball fan.
One of the interesting details in your column is Ballmer's relationship to Clippers head coach Doc Rivers. How would you characterize that relationship?
I got a sense that it's a very warm relationship. It seems as if they have a mutual respect and affection for each other. I laughed when I was talking to Doc, and he said, "Karen, he is the most normal $24 billion owner I have ever come across." And then he paused and he said, "Of course, he's the only man worth $24 billion that I've ever come across."
Has Steve Ballmer changed the team and the culture surrounding the team since he assumed ownership of the Clippers back in August?
My sense is that not as much as people thought. And when I talked to Doc said he was actually encouraging Steve to come by more, to stop in his office, to express his opinions, that he wanted Steve's input. He did not want him to be a hands-off owner. As he said, this man is a very smart businessman, as he's proven. I want to hear his input.
You can find a link to Karen Krause's New York Times column, Stephen A. Ballmer Speaks Loudly and Carries a Big Wallet, at onlyagame.org. Karen, thank you very much.
My pleasure. You're welcome.
African Americans and women of all backgrounds make up a large portion of college athletes in the United States, but that's not the case in professional positions within college athletic departments. In just a moment, we'll look at the challenges and opportunities for female athletic directors. But first, according to a recent report by the University of Central Florida, the number of black coaches in men's college basketball is dropping, and a new group has formed to try to reverse the trend. Last year, 22% of coaches were black. That's a 3 percentage point decline from a decade earlier, and at least a dozen black coaches have been fired this spring. Former Michigan State Athletic Director Merritt Norvell is the executive director of the National Association for Coaching Equity and Development. Merritt, what do you think is behind this recent drop?
I don't know. We don't know exactly the answer to that. We know that the probability of us getting rehired is much lower than it is for other coaches. White coaches do all kinds of atrocious behavior, and they either get retained or they get an equally similar job at a different school. And we know for a fact that if they happen to be non-white coaches, they would not get that same opportunity.
Fewer chances after the NCAA has come down on them or some sort of event like that.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, the NCAA doesn't have to come down on them. But, yeah, if you're involved in an NCAA investigation, then you're kind of toxic.
Well, let's turn to college football. In 2003, the NFL enacted the Rooney Rule, which requires teams to interview at least one minority candidate before hiring a new head coach or general manager. Why wouldn't a similar rule be effective in college football?
In the NFL, there's two people who make the decision. One is the general manager, and the other is the guy that owns the team.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case in college football. College football is a power sport and a cash business. It attracts power influences outside the university that presidents and athletic directors have to contend with because they're willing to take the money. And there's a lot of people that have a lot to say about who gets hired at some of these major institutions.
Your group is new, but advocacy by black coaches is not. You've said that pioneering coaches from the past, like John Chaney, John Thompson, and Nolan Richardson, are upset right now with us because nobody has continued to fight the fight. What do you mean by that exactly?
They went after the basketball coaches and said, what are you guys doing? You know, you're standing on our shoulders. We pay the dues for you guys to be where you are, but you're not paying your dues for the people coming behind you to have a better life and a better career opportunity. And they're right. They're right about that. That, you know, these young coaches today need to understand that, you know, it's like the people that walked across the bridge at Selma. Young people today need to understand that they have rights and privileges today because those people paid the price to make it happen. And the same thing is true with this whole coaching profession.
The National Association for Coaching Equity and Development has already enlisted prominent black coaches like Texas Shaka Smart, Texas Tech's Tubby Smith, mm-hmm. and Georgetown's John Thompson III. What are the specific plans that your group has going forward to address these issues?
There's three pillars to our business. One is training and development. There's an employment piece. Our coaches aren't even getting in the pool at this point in time, which is really frustrating a lot of people. The third pillar is advocacy, and with the older coaches, that's the most important pillar because we have the responsibility to monitor all the NCAA legislation, conference legislation, national legislation that directly impacts our membership as well as minority student athletes.
Merritt Norvell is the executive director of the National Association for Coaching Equity and Development. Merritt, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome, Bill.
Penn State and Rutgers are among the universities that have recently hired female athletic directors to, quote, reinvigorate their programs. Reinvigorate is the word Frank Fitzpatrick uses in a recent Philadelphia Inquirer article titled Female Athletic Directors Slowly Making Inroads at Big Colleges. Given the Sandusky scandal at Penn State that broke in 2011 and the fact that at Rutgers the men's basketball coach, Mike Rice, was fired for abusing his players in 2013, Fitzpatrick might almost have used salvage instead. In a sense, the hiring of female ADs at those universities and the presence of women in the directors' chairs at a few others, including the University of Pennsylvania, Eastern Michigan, and North Carolina State, constitute progress, though, according to Fitzpatrick, only in a sense.
If you look at the numbers going way back, you'll see that there were a number of women's athletic directors prior to Title IX. In fact, most schools had separate women athletic departments and had women heading those. And then when Title IX came about, most of those were combined men and women's programs, and it was the women who lost their jobs.
Though Fitzpatrick found that 20% of all schools at all levels have female athletic directors, only 10% of Division I schools do. And among the 120 football bowl subdivision schools, there are just 7 female ADs. One reason for that imbalance is the preeminence of that sport.
Football is the 500-pound gorilla in college sports. I mean, it's the sport that funds most of the rest of the sports. So I think schools are very reluctant to put someone in a position of running their department who doesn't have at least a little bit of experience in that regard.
Among the Division I schools that have not allowed the absence of a football resume to deter them from hiring a female AD is Princeton, where Molly Marcoux has the job.
Our football coach here is fantastic, and he can handle the X's and O's, and we can work on the larger things, getting the resources that he needs to get our program to the highest possible level.
Just a year ago, Molly Marcoux took over at Princeton, where there hadn't even been a departmental scandal. But Marcoux understands how those hires elsewhere happened.
A lot of times, people hire people as a reaction to the previous person, no matter if it's a male or a female. And, you know, it's always an evolution of a position. Really what matters is how you do when you get into the job and take the situation and build from where you start.
Marcoux was an outstanding ice hockey and soccer player during her undergraduate years at Princeton. She moved a few miles down the road to Lawrenceville, a private secondary school, as an assistant athletic director, and then acquired considerable managerial experience as senior vice president and executive director of Chelsea Piers, Connecticut. As the Philadelphia Inquirer's Frank Fitzpatrick sees it, her success and the success of other women in similar positions could create in college presidents elsewhere the courage and imagination they presently lack.
There are school presidents that would love to hire a woman athletic director, believe me. But they're looking at their alumni and their big donors and people who are a little more wary and a little more skeptical. And so, you know, the progress has been a little slower. But if their success at Penn State, if their success at Rutgers, if these women who are hired to reinvigorate the programs do so, I think we may finally see that glass ceiling smashed.
Everywhere it happens, male assistant athletic directors and perhaps some upwardly mobile female assistant athletic directors as well will gather with brooms to sweep up the shards. This week, a federal judge approved a settlement between the National Football League and more than 5,000 former players who had sued the league. The agreement is expected to cost the NFL about $1 billion over 65 years and will compensate former players suffering from various medical conditions. The agreement was originally reached in August 2013, but Judge Anita Brody twice asked the two sides to make revisions. Michael McCann is the director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire. He's also a regular contributor to Sports Illustrated. Michael, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me back on.
How does this agreement differ from the one originally struck?
The main difference, Bill, is that there's more money available for players and there's more certainty over the methods that will be used to determine how much each player gets. And the pool of money appears to be considerably larger, though many would say not enough, but it looks like there'll be more money available for the retired players.
While the players' cases differ widely, can you walk us through the process and what a likely outcome for a qualified player might be based on this agreement?
So my understanding is that it will vary greatly as to what disability the retired player can show. Some of the more serious long-term neurological degenerative diseases are going to lead to certainly higher healthcare costs and thus more money from the settlement, perhaps millions of dollars. Whereas retired players who are not showing those types of serious ailments may be looking more in the ballpark of over $100,000 over the remainder of their lives. So it will depend greatly on the illnesses that befall the retired players as to how much money they'll likely receive from the settlement.
There is no cap on what the league pays former players for concussions, dementia, and Alzheimer's disease, but you wrote back in January that chronic traumatic encephalopathy is the problem that is, quote, most underserved in this settlement. Is that still a concern?
It still is a concern. There are many health advocates who believe that CTE will remain underfunded, that the inability or lack of certainty as to showing it exists in its relationship to football continues to pose a problem. So I think there's a healthy amount of skepticism about whether or not the settlement will adequately reach all of the individuals who really need it. That said, there's certainly evidence suggesting that it will reach many retired players and it will give many of them a significant amount of money quickly, as opposed to waiting years to litigate where the outcome would be uncertain. And in some cases, some of the players, retired players, would pass away.
What about other injuries? What else is covered in this settlement? Say somebody can't walk because of a spinal injury or something like that.
So a spinal injury would be covered because it remains a neurological problem, and it's expected that other retired players who suffer all sorts of injuries will be able to get better treatment through the settlement. But clearly, the intended beneficiaries of the settlement are those suffering from the more serious degenerative neurological problems.
About 200 players have opted out of the settlement. What is their motivation, and what's likely to happen with them?
I think the prevailing thought is that many of them feel like the settlement is not enough, that not enough money will be available to pay for health treatment. And I think there are some retired players who believe the NFL is at fault and that a settlement is a way of evading taking full responsibility. Now, Players Association could also be at fault as well, because they agreed to the terms that didn't lead to adequate safety for players. But that said, what will happen with them, they will pursue their own cases. And it's possible that their own cases may prevail. But I think there's reason to think that the NFL has a number of strong defenses. They may be vindicated, but they're certainly taking a chance.
Will the settlement announced on Wednesday be appealed? And if so, would that delay payment to former injured players?
Yeah, it does appear as if there will be an appeal filed by some individuals who are not satisfied by it. Really, at that point, it depends on how the federal court treats the appeal. Will it be considered an appeal that delays entire implementation, or are there more narrow issues that are being appealed that will allow implementation of other aspects of the settlement that are agreed to? It remains to be seen exactly what the appeal is about.
Michael McCann is the director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
How do you get scouts from nearly every NFL team to show up at a Connecticut suburb to watch a workout featuring a pair of Division III prospects, a Canadian running back from Yale, and a 28-year-old former minor league baseball player? Tell them agent Joe Linta organized the tryout. Sports Illustrated's Emily Kaplan has profiled Linta, and she joins me. Emily, you call Linta the chief advocate for the NFL draft's marginalia. How has he earned that distinction?
Yeah, it's quite the title to have if you're an agent. But Joe Linta is one of the most fascinating agents I've come across in covering the NFL. His chief responsibility is looking out for guys who've kind of been cast off for these scouting services and kind of underrated and kind of, you know, not the Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariotas. His job is to pump them up, and if they deserve opportunities, find opportunities for them. And over the years, he's found some gems.
You write that about half of Linta's prospects will not be drafted, but Linta has a history of representing undrafted players who do end up making teams. One of them is the Bengals' Jason DeMonch, who went undrafted in 2013. How did he make the Bengals roster?
Yeah, Jason DeMonch is a fascinating story. Joe had heard about Jason. He's the son of a Haitian immigrant from New Jersey, had, you know, not the typical upbringing, and ended up at Southern Illinois. Joe found out about him and actually had to drive through this epic blizzardy snowstorm. I really wish I was there part of this drive. Joe said he didn't think he'd make it out alive. Scouted him, and the minute he met Jason, he knew that, A, he had the skill set to make the NFL, and B, his personality was something that was so infectious, Joe needed to represent him. So Joe signed him on the roster. And because Joe is such a trusted voice among NFL front offices, the Bengals brought him in for a pre-draft visit. And though he went undrafted, they picked him up.
As you write, Linta has represented more than 100 players over his 22 years as an agent. He negotiated Joe Flacco's six-year, $120.6 million deal, which was the largest in NFL history at the time. And he has three current starting quarterbacks among his clientele. What does he know that other agents don't?
Joe Linta is a football guy. You know, there's some agents who pride themselves in being a marketing guy. You know, they're going to get their clients endorsements, this and that. But Joe really kind of prides himself as a scout. And whenever times he signs a player, A, he watches film, and B, he puts them through a personal workout where he checks their hip movements and things like that. And if he believes that he has this caliber of style that he can play in the NFL, then Joe will sign them on.
You also write that Linta lives comfortably, which doesn't surprise me if he has a client with a $120.6 million deal. He says he isn't in this for the money. So why does Linta still bother doing things like driving through blizzards to southern Illinois to look at people nobody else is looking at?
This is something about personal satisfaction. He has found this niche of seeing guys and helping them realize their dreams when no one else really believes in them. And for Joe, I think that's kind of why he's in this.
What does he do when he isn't scouting?
So he spends, in the fall, 20 to almost 30 hours a week coaching high school football in Connecticut. And he said, you know, I can still make time for my clients, but this is something else I find personal satisfaction in.
The 2015 NFL Draft will be held this week in Chicago. The first round is on Thursday. The final six rounds will transpire over the course of Friday and Saturday. Should any of the 16 players represented by Linta bother tuning in on Thursday?
Maybe not Thursday. He definitely has a couple guys who might make it in the third round, like that Yale running back, Tyler Varga, that you mentioned. And he also has a Harvard player who he might go pretty high. And by high, I mean fourth round.
Emily Kaplan is a staff writer for Sports Illustrated and the MMQB. You can link to her story, No Ordinary Agent, at onlyagame.org. Emily, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much.
Bruce Lee, Lawrence of Arabia, and the fictional demigod Percy Jackson share supporting roles in the new book, Natural Born Heroes. The idea goes something like this. All of these men started out as average, ordinary humans before they learned to do extraordinary things. And if they can do it, the book says, so can we. Only a Game's Karen Given recently met up with the author on tour.
I'm usually game for Christopher McDougall's experiments. When we first met in 2010, I took off my running shoes and joined him for a barefoot jog. 5 years later, that book is still on McDougall's mind.
I'm Christopher McDougall, author of Born to Run.
But I'm pretty sure that's not the book we're supposed to be talking about today.
Oh, author of Natural Born Heroes.
Born to Run sold 3 million copies worldwide and was credited with launching the barefoot running movement. Put Born to Run and Natural Born Heroes side by side on a bookshelf, and you might have trouble telling them apart. But a similar cover isn't the only thing they have in common.
You know, Born to Run, I got a ton of credit for, like, launching the barefoot movement. It's like, dude, I was the dude on the surfboard that happened to be there when the wave came. Like, I saw the wave coming, but it was coming, and I feel the same way about this now.
McDougall is 6'4". In Born to Run, he set out to prove that you don't have to be small and thin to be a runner. In Natural Born Heroes, he says those guys who spend their evenings lifting weights at the gym have it all wrong. You don't have to be big to be strong.
I had no idea I could move that way. I think that was the most exciting part.
Amelia Failing has come to an indoor climbing gym in Somerville, Massachusetts for McDougall's book tour / parkour clinic. Parkour isn't an easy thing to define, but it's basically just a way of moving around a space, usually an urban landscape, by jumping and climbing over obstacles instead of just going around them. And Failing's never done anything like it before.
Let's look at it objectively.
Yeah.
What you did today.
today, I jumped on top of that 5-foot block there, jumped on top of the platform that's a foot higher than that, contemplated jumping onto the wall, but then thought maybe I should give that, you know, till the next time. It felt like I was on adult monkey bars.
And I gotta say, the look on your face was like a 5-year-old.
I know, that's what I felt like. I was trying not to smile so much, but I was having so much fun.
This clinic might be fun, but McDougall says natural movement, the discipline that inspired parkour, has its roots in a turn-of-the-century tragedy.
There's a French naval officer watching a volcano explode, and he's trying to rescue people. And he's watching people die because they can't master these simple little movements. They can't climb a rope to get up on the boat. They can't jump across a little ravine. They couldn't pick up like a child.
George Hébert believed humans had gotten away from their animal selves, the part of us that instinctively knows how to run and climb and fight. He set out to reintroduce those skills to a generation of French Marines. But World War I began, and Europe had more important things to worry about. For the next 100 years, Hébert's techniques were mostly forgotten, until a couple of guys in France in the 1980s started to bring them back. Maybe you've seen this video. It has 38 million views on YouTube, and there are hundreds more just like it. I can barely watch as these guys climb walls, leap over parked cars, and jump from rooftop to rooftop with a completely unnecessary aerial somersault in between. Parkour spread across the world with videos like this one. By the time the sport made it to Pennsylvania, where McDougall lives, he knew he'd found his next book.
I was like, oh, man, I know I got to do this because I got to research this book, but I am going to the hospital.
I can barely contain my skepticism. Jumping from building to building, leaping over parked cars, that's just crazy talk.
You look remarkably unconvinced. you're like, yeah, dude.
I got to say, I mean, really, yeah, I can't imagine doing it.
I'm going to try one little thing here.
McDougall slips off his sandals and pushes off the table in front of us like a spring. Almost effortlessly, the guy who compares his body type to a refrigerator hops up on the table and back down again. Even I have to admit, it kind of looks like fun.
You are hardwired to get satisfaction and joy from anything that's good for the species. So if it's good for your animal self, you're going to be rewarded for it. You can get a burst of endorphins.
Those endorphins are why, McDougall believes, this year more people will complete an adventure challenge like the Tough Mudder or Spartan Race than will run a half marathon.
This institutionalized machine-based fitness thing like doesn't work. We don't like it. The dropout rate in gyms is 60%. They sign up in January, and by Easter, they're gone. Every year, it's the only business that makes a profit from the fact that people hate it.
When McDougall suggested runners ditch their traditional shoes, millions of us did. And so many got injured that the most popular brand of minimalist shoes was recently forced to settle a $3.7 million class action lawsuit. Dan Edwards of Parkour Generations, a London-based training group, says he hopes Natural Born Heroes does for parkour what Born to Run did for the barefoot running movement, except for that part where people got hurt.
Absolutely, yeah. The reason we started teaching was that, you know, young people, kids especially, were going out and doing it without any guidance. So we wanted to create a place where they could come and get good guidance if they wanted it and learn safely and correctly.
Be mindful of your steps, be mindful of your space, mindful of other people.
McDougall and Edwards are working this book tour together. After McDougall gets the crowd excited about parkour, Edwards lets them give it a try. But he doesn't show them exactly what to do. Edwards says parkour is about challenge, discovery, exploration, adaptation, and self-knowledge. And it's definitely not about all those pretty jumps you can watch on your computer screen.
Your kids, they climb on stuff, they walk on the wall, not on the pavement. You know, they'll balance on things, they'll fool around, they'll explore. And they love doing that. It's a natural thing to play. It's play, right? And parkour is, in a way, it's just allowing adults especially, it's like giving them permission to play again. And all we do is we give it a little bit of focus, a little bit of discipline. But effectively, it's play. And that's why everyone smiles so much, because it's like, you know, oh, this is, I remember doing this when I was growing up. Why did I stop doing this?
Will Natural Born Heroes inspire millions to cast off traditional gyms the way Born to Run led so many to try running without shoes? As he watches the parkour students climb over walls and each other, Christopher McDougall hopes that it will. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
I will not be reading the Tell-A-Lot autobiography of French swimmer Amaury Laveau for several reasons, and one of them is I don't have to. BBC News in Paris revealed this week that the book, by the fellow who won gold at the London Olympics and retired in 2013, includes such gems as some of us wouldn't spit at a little line of coke from time to time. For others, it's not just a little line, it's a complete motorway covered in white powder which they zoom down at top speed. So much for spoilers. The French Swimming Federation is outraged by those lines, and also by the ones in the book, and probably by Laveau's contention that a trainer with the team warned the athletes about when they would be tested for drugs. He was going to do television commentaries, said French Swimming Federation Vice President Lucien Gasteldello. He can forget that. Who would speak to him now? Touché, eh? I bet Monsieur Laveau wishes he'd thought of that before he turned author. Now he's doomed to sit alone in the silent bookstores beside piles of sex, drugs, and swimming. You are the king of the divan, quel me dit en passant. I am the king of the divan. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Coming up on Only a Game, a look back at a Major League Baseball game you almost certainly did not attend because almost nobody did. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I certainly wasn't there.
No. It's the end of April, so we're going to talk some football. Dallas Cowboys defensive end Greg Hardy was arrested on domestic violence charges last May when he was still with Carolina. The charges were dropped in February, but on Wednesday, the NFL suspended him for 10 games next season based on the findings of its own investigation. Has the league's response to domestic violence or even accusations of domestic violence changed?
I think a little bit. I think this would not have happened a few years ago, adding the 10-game suspension onto the 15 he missed last year. But if you accept the premise that the league can do its own investigating, then you must accept the premise that the league can do its own punishing, and that's what it's doing here.
Jameis Winston, now out from under the shadow of the NCAA, announced this week that the crab legs he was accused of stealing last spring had in fact been a gift. So, what did he do? Walk past the checkout counter without telling anybody about the gift?
He says he knew somebody there. As he puts it, he met a dude inside Publix, and the guy said that, you know, anytime he wanted to come in there, it would be okay, and he would set him up with some crab legs. This is interesting because if he had accepted the gift while he was at Florida State, while he was playing, he could have been suspended. So Jameis Winston would rather be thought a thief than a violator of NCAA rules. Something is wrong here.
On Monday, the Philadelphia Eagles signed Tim Tebow to a one-year non-guaranteed contract. And word out of Philadelphia is that Tebow has improved dramatically as a quarterback. Did that word come out before or after the Eagles signed him?
Actually, it came out after the Eagles signed him when he was in camp with the New England Patriots. They did a three-day kind of training camp thing with the Philadelphia Eagles. So this is Chip Kelly's turn to prove he's the smartest person on earth, and he can make some chicken salad out of that which you cannot make chicken salad out of.
Until Wednesday, Scott Brooks probably thought the worst thing that happened to him this year was having to coach the Oklahoma City Thunder without the consistent services of MVP Kevin Durant, but that was only until Wednesday, right?
Yes, because the worst thing actually is not coaching the Oklahoma City Thunder with or without Kevin Durant. Brooks got fired. This came as no surprise to most of the rest of the NBA. You know, he had a terrible siege of injuries this year, but there was some indication that he had lost the locker room as well.
Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao will meet in the ring on May the 2nd. Charlie, ticket prices became public this week. Were you disappointed to learn that all the $10,000 seats were gone?
Yeah, actually, I put in my bid several weeks ago and never heard back.
That's a shame.
I think my check probably got lost in the mail or bounced higher than Pluto. However, it's really good because I've saved that $10,000 and now I have it to put in a bid for the ticket on StubHub that's going for $141,575.25.
Mm-hmm. That's a good
seat. So it pays to wait, Bill.
Yeah, absolutely. Charlie, cable provider Comcast has dropped its $45 billion bid to buy its rival Time Warner Cable. Normally, cable industry news might tempt you to scream sports at this point. But this is a sports story for fans of a certain Major League Baseball franchise, right?
Yeah, because now that the merger has fallen through, 70% of the people who live in Los Angeles will not get to watch the Dodgers on television for a while. The merger would have gotten the station that carries the Dodgers into more homes. But now that the merger has fallen through, it's going to get them in no more homes.
It's contempt for the public is
it's terrible.
Constant and current.
Of course, the rest of the nation is standing up and cheering at this.
All right. We've all seen those air cannons that shoot T-shirts into the crowd at NBA games. Is it fair to say the folks at the University of Nebraska and Omaha have outdone that stunt?
Yes. The University of Nebraska Omaha is going to feature at its new $81 million stadium for its indoor sports, a taco cannon.
Yeah.
An Omaha taco shop called Voodoo Tacos is going to fire foil-wrapped tacos into fans.
Whether they like it or not.
Whether they like it or not. The problem is the taco's not going to be very good once it reaches your hands.
I wouldn't think so.
Much less once it bounces off about nine other people's hands and falls from the second deck to the first deck.
I'm thinking the first person who leaves the arena on a stretcher with a taco injury is going to be the end of this stuff.
Well, not just that, but I mean, I am terrified of all of Section 215 being showered
handling
with taco shrapnel.
Oh, we can go that one better.
I know, we get sports!
Remember that last week we agreed that nothing could be better or perhaps worse than a replica of the Stanley Cup made out of bacon. Check out what one restaurant chain has done to celebrate the sandwich shop's endorsement deal with former Oregon quarterback Marcus Mariota.
Subway has made a Marcus Mariota bust out of a sandwich.
Excellent.
It doesn't look like a sandwich. It's got a big freaking head in the middle of it.
It doesn't look
sandwiches
very much
like don't have heads in the middle of them. I'm sorry. And I don't even want to guess what the hair is. But, I mean, would you eat something that would look at you like that?
No.
I mean, I won't even eat a fish head.
No.
This is awful.
No, it's awful.
It is awful.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, but you cannot find his likeness in lunch meat anywhere yet. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Despite making the playoffs for the third straight season, the Oakland Athletics finished among the bottom 10 Major League Baseball teams in 2014 attendance. This season, the A's aren't faring much better at the gate. After their first two homestands, they were averaging about 25,000 fans a night. But it's been worse. Claire McNear of Vice Sports has written about a night at the Oakland Coliseum that was historic for all the wrong reasons. Claire, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much.
April 17th, 1979, the Seattle Mariners visit the Oakland A's and only 250 people show up. That can't be right. I'm missing a zero or two, right?
No. It was a rough time for the franchise, this kind of moment of existential tension. They sold 653 tickets that night, but by all accounts, you know, fewer than half that number actually showed up. You know, it was a rough time. It was the fans had kind of let go of the team. The owner, this guy Charlie Finley, desperately wanted to get rid of the team, had sold off most of the marquee players. He wasn't paying for TV or radio contracts too much. In 1978, the first month of games was broadcast only on the UC Berkeley student station, which didn't even reach the Coliseum. So yeah, they just had college kids. Those were the official A's announcers for a month there in 78.
The attendance at A's games was bad throughout that season, but I understand there were some factors that made it especially bad that night.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was just a miserable night for baseball. It was a Tuesday night. It was early on in the season. It was already clear that it was going to be a bad season. It had been raining earlier in the day. By that night, when they finally started playing, the temperature was in the 40s. And it was just windy and foggy and just, you know, you didn't want to be sitting out at a baseball game that night.
You write that the fans on that night, when there were only 250 of them in attendance, quote, huddled together behind home plate for warmth, it seemed like. You spoke with some of the players who were on the field that night. What do they remember about the crowd? Well, crowd, that's not quite right, is it?
I mean, it's the first baseman came out on the field and saw how few people were there and started trying to count them. They could hear people ordering peanuts from the outfield. They were calling up to people, the few fans who were on the upper deck, telling them to come on down to the lower deck, come get closer. So just a massive empty place.
The front office was pretty much empty as well, right?
That's right. Charlie Finley fired just about everybody. At one point, there were only six people working in the front office, one of whom was a local Oakland teenager who would later be known as MC Hammer. His name was Stanley Burrell. And he was, Finley hired him when he was in his teens. And by 1979, he was the executive vice president. So he would kind of strut around the clubhouse and do his thing.
Well, tell me a little bit about the game itself, Claire, because I understand that the fans who did show up did see a pretty good ball game.
That's right. The A's got up to a quick lead. You know, the Mariners tied it. It was 5-5. And then you've got your quintessential baseball moment. Bases loaded in the bottom of the ninth with two outs, and the A's backup catcher, Jim Essien, walks up to the plate. And Essien just had a nasty flu that day. You know, he said he didn't even think he could play baseball. But he gets up to the plate, and he singles. And it's the first A's walk-off victory of the year. The first of not very many.
And of course, the crowd, such as it was, went wild.
That's right. They did. They did. You know, and they were saying it was actually kind of nice because you could really go and interact with the players. You could get their autographs. You could almost have a conversation with them. It was so quiet. You know, the third baseman went around thanking everyone for coming and for staying out in the cold.
Do you think those former players with whom you spoke feel that they're heroes for being part of that game, or are they a little embarrassed?
To a man, they were all just saying that they were really grateful to have this opportunity to play in the majors, even if it didn't really feel like the major leagues at that point. And, you know, they were professionals. They were doing their job and happy to get to do it on at least a big stage, if not necessarily with a big audience.
You can find a link to Claire McNair's Vice Sports article, Remembering the Worst Attended MLB Game of All Time, at onlyagame.org. Claire, thank you very much for speaking with me. This has been fun.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you've ever wondered about the country's greatest croquet rivalry, well, wonder no more. St. John's College and the U.S. Naval Academy have competed each year since 1983. The Johnnies and the Middies draw thousands of Annapolis Cup spectators annually, but as reporter Hans Anderson found out, not all of them are there just to watch croquet.
If you're like me, you haven't played croquet since you were maybe 10 years old. Bill Hebert is like me.
No, I know we had a set when I was little, and I asked my mom about it coming over here today, and I said, Mom, did we even know how to play? She goes, no, we would just set it up and hit the ball around the yard. I said, that's what I thought.
Even though he doesn't know the rules, Hebert is here to root for Navy. He graduated from the Naval Academy in 1982. Hebert is impressed by the spectators and by the way they look.
I walked down West Street coming here, and I saw the excitement building. And I noticed everybody was dressed for the part, you know, with bow ties and bucks, and the women had hats and sundresses. And so I'm just as excited as anybody to be here.
Here's a quick refresher on how to play croquet from Sam Collins.
You know, get you and your partners croquet balls, like, through all the wickets before the other team in any way you can. that's all.
Collins is the Imperial Wicket at St. John's College. That's a fancy word for team captain. He's a senior, and this will be his last year competing for the Annapolis Cup. To take home that cup, his team will have to win 3 of the 5 games that take place today. There are 3 fields, and games take place simultaneously.
It's like the, you know, big sports event on campus. It's like the only sport that this school is known for, basically. And, you know, we do it pretty well.
That's Maddie Minotti, a freshman here at St. John's. It's a small liberal arts college in Annapolis, not to be confused with St. John's University, the former basketball powerhouse in Queens, New York. This St. John's has just 4 intercollegiate sports: sailing, crew, fencing, and croquet. So today is a major draw for alumni.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 33rd annual Annapolis Cup croquet match!
Before the match can begin, the crowd is addressed by St. John's president, Christopher Nelson, and then Naval Academy commandant, Captain William Byrne. And finally, the croquet teams take the pitch. The Naval Academy is decked out in their traditional croquet whites and matching ties, but St. John's wears a different uniform every year. Today, it's Hawaiian shirts, cutoffs, sunglasses, and fake mustaches. Navy has won the previous 2 years, a surprise considering that St. John's has won 25 of the 32 matches since 1983. If you really want to get insight into this game, it's best to talk to Nancy Morgan.
It's just a fascinating game. Slow, like watching grass grow.
Morgan is here with her friend Bill Krause. They're from Ginger Cove, a retirement community here in Annapolis, and they play a lot of croquet. They even head down to Florida in the winter to play a few matches. St. John's and Navy train against Ginger Cove a few weeks before the Annapolis Cup, says Bill Krause.
We play the Johnnies, and sometimes we win, and that surprises them because we're a few years older. And we've been playing the middies, I guess, for about 23 years.
It's a toss-up today. We played both Navy and St. John's the last couple of weeks. They all have good teams, so it'll be fun to see who wins. But it'll be close, I say.
Next to where Krause and Morgan are camped out, there are a number of spectators standing in front of a dry erase scoreboard. The scores look like fractions. Nilos Sakalariou is managing that scoreboard, and I ask him to explain what the scores mean.
The game is won, or each field game is won, when both players or both people from one team have completed 14 wickets. Right? So.
But when you ask him whether or not he's paying attention.
Honestly, no. I wait for updates from a couple of buddies that are circling around the field. And I update this, and it says clearly score is possibly delayed. It should say score is delayed, possibly because of entertainment, let's just say.
The so-called entertainment is really the main event. Drinking, swing dancing, eating cucumber sandwiches, and dressing up. Most spectators are wearing sundresses and bow ties. Some are dressed in Victorian-era clothing, like Catherine Martin of the Victorian Society of Falls Church. She's in a replica 1883 outfit with matching hat and parasol.
And, of course, the parasol helps out a lot. So we've learned that over the years. You better have a parasol out here, otherwise you get sunburned. We're just thankful it's sunny and beautiful today. But if you're in a corset in several layers, it's a little warm.
Señoras y señores, damas y caballeros, we're about to announce the most recent status of the game.
All right, on court three.
St. John's goes ahead 2-1, then Navy wins a game, and the match is tied. But the crowd has all but vanished. Swing dancing has ended, the alcohol tent stopped serving beer nearly 2 hours ago. You can't find a cucumber sandwich anywhere. Only the true croquet fans are left watching the last game. Ginger Cove's Bill Krause understands why.
Not much of a spectator sport, but an occasion like this, of course, everybody's here to have fun and have a drink or something and enjoy the weather.
And it seems like everybody does. Oh, and in case you're wondering, St. John's College does win the final game and takes home its 26th Annapolis Cup. For Only a Game, I'm Hans Anderson.
Now, as a quick reminder, pick up all your trash, be considerate, make sure that all your cups and bottles are thrown away in the bins that are within easy walking distance of each of the entrances. No alcohol is to be taken off campus onto the street. Make sure that you do everything.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. And our intern is Keely Flanagan. We had help this week from Eric Larrabee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Nancy Morgan, whose enthusiasm for croquet is surpassed only by her honesty.
It's just a fascinating game. Slow, like watching grass grow.
So you want to hit those croquet balls on the grass too much, because it'll slow down how fast it grows. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.